I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Barring any defections from the Democrats, it looks like Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will be the first black woman to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court in our nation's history. It's unclear at this point whether any Republican senators like Murkowski, Collins, or Romney will vote for her. She sat through 2 days of aggressive, even hostile questioning from Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, most notably from Cruz, Hawley, and Cotton. They attacked Jackson's sentencing of several child sex predators, implying she was soft on crime, even though she is reportedly within the mainstream compared to other federal judges. She has the support of the Fraternal Order of Police and a number of victim rights groups. Judge Jackson was questioned about her role as a defense attorney defending alleged terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, about critical race theory, the 1619 Project, her church attendance, children's books about race. She got emotional last night when asked about what advice she would give to young people about her nomination. She talked about being a freshman at Harvard.
I think the first semester I was really homesick. I was really questioning, do I belong here? Can I make it in this environment? And I was walking through the yard in the evening, and a black woman I did not know was passing me on the sidewalk. And she looked at me, and I guess she knew how I was feeling. And she leaned over as we crossed and said, "Persevere." I would tell them to persevere.
Well, today on Radio Times, as we wipe tears from our eyes, what we learned about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the Judiciary Committee, and the Supreme Court nomination process. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Kimberly Mutcherson. She's co-dean, professor of law at Rutgers Law School across the river in Camden. Kimberly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
And joining us is also Dahlia Lithwick, and she writes about the courts, the law for Slate. She also hosts the podcast called Amicus. And Dahlia Lithwick, it's been a little while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be with you.
Well, let me begin with just this historic moment. I do want to get into what we heard over the last couple of days, but I don't want to lose track of the sight of the fact, and I guess I'm looking at you, Kim, that this is a black woman, the first black woman who has been nominated to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. As I mentioned, barring any unforeseen circumstances, it looks like she's got the job. And I just want to give you a chance to comment on this moment.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's a marvelous time to be alive, right? To watch history in the making. And certainly, you know, Judge Jackson, it would be hard to find somebody whose qualifications are higher than hers. And, you know, watching her go through this process with so much poise and grace and composure is incredibly impressive. And I think, you know, I think a lot about the young people who will see her, right, and for whom their horizons will open up substantially, and they will think to themselves, wow, there are options here that I had not thought of before.
And Dahlia, I'm thinking about what she said about being a Harvard freshman. Do I belong here? I mean, clearly she belonged in that seat before the Judiciary Committee. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, it was really the other kind of tear-up moment that happened right before that involved Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, the only African-American on the Judiciary Committee, who essentially said just that to her, who really, I think, rose to, you know, speak to both how historic the moment was, but also that she belonged there, that she had kind of, you know, played by all the rules, done everything right, and that despite, you know, what he characterized as some really despicable personal insinuations and attacks, that she had not just sort of persevered, but thrived and owned it. And there was, it was really one of 2 minutes, the other was right, the little clip you played, where she teared up, just sort of having him say, you know, he cited the Langston Hughes poem, America, and sort of really was at pains to say, I see what you are and what you've done to get here. And, you know, please, like, slough off the abuse because you earned every second of it. And it was an incredible touching moment that followed on the heels of some really sort of pernicious attack.
Well, and I do want to play that touching moment, but a little bit later on in the hour. And I do want to maybe, Kim, I can go back to you. This is certainly not the first contentious Supreme Court nomination hearing. Judge Kavanaugh certainly, or now Justice Kavanaugh, certainly comes to mind. He got angry. He got aggressive. You know, she had to stay really within this very narrow lane. Help us understand why she was so limited in her responses.
Right. I mean, so the first thing is, I think that we are getting an incredible lesson in real time about how the rules are different depending upon who you are and your identity categories. I mean, I don't think any of us could imagine Judge Jackson coming in front of the Senate with the level of one, entitlement. Of anger, of a sense of how dare you ask these questions to me in the way that Justice Kavanaugh did. So, you know, she is a woman who has worked in and been in predominantly white spaces for a very long time and a very elite echelon of our society. And one of the things that you learn as a Black woman in particular in those spaces is how to be able to navigate them and how to navigate them in a way that allows you to continue to be successful. And she is putting on a masterclass.
What, and was it Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high?
Exactly.
I mean, we sort of saw that for a couple of days.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But also, you know, one of the things that I think is really important for people to keep in mind is that maintaining that level of composure in the face of wild and deep and unacceptable disrespect has a psychic toll. Right. I mean, sort of pushing down whatever you might be feeling in order to make sure that you're putting forward the right face, that you don't get labeled as, you know, an angry Black woman who can't control her emotions. That takes its toll over time. Absolutely.
And I think we heard that in her voice. Davi, let me go to you. And actually something that you wrote in Slate, criticizing the Democrats on the committee for not coming either more to her defense or using the hearings to make a case for progressive politics or progressive legal ideas. And I want you to speak to that.
I mean, I think they're two separate critiques, and I guess I would disaggregate them. The first, I think, just goes to what Kim said, which is the toll on Judge Jackson sitting with her family, with her parents, and being subject to, you know, by the end of the day yesterday, really just very, very, not just sort of attacks and character attacks, but just rudeness and bullying. You know, Josh Hawley not letting her finish a sentence, Ted Cruz screaming over her as she tried to answer. And I think that, you know, when I think back to the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, when he was attacked personally and bracket, you know, what he was alleged to have done, Republicans on the committee just surged into, you know, his defense and started shouting, Lindsey Graham shouting, you know, Chuck Grassley hollering, in some ways because somebody has to absorb that and to at least perform, you know, outrage and anger. And it was really striking to see, you know, Chairman Dick Durbin kind of almost completely ineffectually trying to shut it down, but not shutting it down. At one point, Senator Cruz from Texas started shouting, "You gave Lindsey Graham 20 extra minutes. You know, why don't I get extra time?" And there was almost complete radio silence from the Democrats on the committee until, as I said, Senator Booker at the very end stood up and really, I think, rallied to her defense. So that's just a sense that there's an asymmetry here. And if the nominee, for all the reasons you just heard, cannot show a lick of anger, then somebody has to step into the breach and do that. And we didn't see it. So that's the first piece. The second piece is simply, you would have thought sitting in that chamber that nothing is happening down the street at the Supreme Court. And yet we're in the midst of I think, a singular term where abortion rights stand to be reversed. They've already been totally nullified in Texas by this court. Gun rights are going to be expanded. The EPA's ability to act is going to be kneecapped. This is the most consequential term I've seen in 20 years covering the court. And we heard almost no mention of it. It was as though what was happening in that chamber had absolutely no bearing on what's happening on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I found it an immense wasted teaching moment to explain to America that this unelected, you know, lifetime appointed judiciary is before our eyes reshaping the legal world that we live in.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Kim. And I mean, she hasn't been she hasn't gotten the job yet, but nonetheless, it looks like it's going to happen if she and when she sits on the court. And she didn't say what her judicial philosophy was. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly what to make of that. But if she sits on the court, do you see her sitting with the left or the right or in the middle? I mean, taking Breyer's place.
You know, I think it's meaningful that she was a clerk for Justice Breyer. I would hope that she would maintain some of his qualities, but not all of them. And I could imagine that she will be a really lovely bookend to Justice Sotomayor, who I think has, you know, I think last time I was, or one time when I was on here, I think I referred to her as an intersectional RBG.
Right.
And I think the same of Judge Jackson, right? Somebody who comes into the space with not just experiences with the law, but who has wide experiences in the world that differ from so many of the justices who have been on our Supreme Court. And that matters, right? We pretend like, or people like to pretend like, if you are, you know, a white man, that you are perfectly objective, right? And nothing about the way that you make decisions is subjective or has anything to do with where you were born and who your parents were and what schools you went to. And we don't give that same benefit to people of color and to women. And yet all of us move through the world based on what our life experiences have been. And that's a reason why you can't have a court that's homogenous. You want to have a court with people who have, for whom America has meant different things over the course of their lifetime. It's valuable, it's important, and it's necessary.
And we're almost up in a break here. And the fact that she has worked as a defense attorney,
yes,
that, I mean, that puts her in a very unique category.
Absolutely, absolutely, right? Our system works because there are prosecutors and there are public defenders. And if we don't have public defenders, then our system is an unjust system right from the beginning. We have to have people who do that work.
Well, we are talking about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. We watched and listened to here on public radio and WHYY 3 days of confirmation hearings, 2 days of really intense and hostile questioning. And we are talking about what we learned about her, what we learned about members of the Judiciary Committee, and talking with Kimberly Murchison, co-dean, professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and law for Slate, hosts the podcast Amicus. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with our guests about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, finishing up 3 days of confirmation hearings on Wednesday. And this, of course, was before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let me play a couple of clips, and I'll start with during Judge Jackson's Supreme Court confirmation hearing, Senator Josh Hawley asked repeated questions about her sentencing record in child pornography cases. Let's give it a listen. It's about a minute.
I want to try to understand here, is it your view that society is too hard on sex offenders? You say they truly are shunned in society. You wrote that many of these laws are products of a climate of fear, hatred, and revenge. So just is that still your view? I mean, do you think that these laws are too tough, that we're too tough on sex offenders? Explain what you meant in this case in 2013, and it seems to be the same thing you said many years ago.
Senator, it's not the same thing I said many years ago. Many years ago, as a law school student, I was evaluating a new set of legislation, state laws about registration, and I was analyzing them as law students do. wasn't about the sex crime. It was about the characterization of the law.
Dahlia, let me go to you. And these are horrendous crimes. So we need to make sure that, you know, we're not in any way defending child sex predators. But nonetheless, how did this line of questioning, and we heard from Holly, how did that become almost mainstream?
It happened in a blink, and it was really fascinating to watch it metastasize in the span of a week. So, you know, in the weeks while Judge Jackson's, after she was named and everybody pored over her record, it became pretty clear that there wasn't going to be a really coordinated, concerted attack. And then suddenly last Thursday night, Senator Hawley floated initially on Twitter this idea that, quote unquote, our children are all unsafe. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, that she's soft on crime or that she was too easy sentencing child predators, but that she actually somehow made all of our children less safe. And it was debunked almost immediately, roundly across the political spectrum. We heard from sentencing experts, from judges across the political and ideological spectrum, even from somebody at National Review Online who objected to Judge Jackson's nomination, but still said this was demagoguery and scurrilous, and that cherry picking a tiny handful of her sentencing decisions and reading them out of context was wildly inappropriate. He characterized it as a smear. And so I think on Monday, most of us expected that Senator Hawley would drop this, that it had no traction, that anybody who looked at her sentencing record said it's actually perfectly consistent with, you know, problems with the sentencing guidelines and the lack of updating of the sentencing guidelines and the ways in which judges are forced to make decisions. And yet not only did Hawley sort of pick up the ball and double down, but quickly on Monday, we saw Senator Marsha Blackburn picked it up. Lindsey Graham didn't quite embrace it, but certainly conscripted Hawley to do it in his opening remarks. And then by Wednesday, it was absolutely, as you say, mainstream across the board. We heard senator after senator, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, double down, triple down on these cases, these sentencing cases that she explained, as she attempted to explain in the clip you just played, why she decided the way she decided. She said, this is a tiny handful of cases among hundreds that I've decided. This is a problem with the sentencing guidelines. This is a problem with Congress not updating the rules. She tried and tried and tried to say that this was decontextualized, and yet really by the very end of Senator Hawley's final round of questioning, he was shouting at her, do you regret these sentences? Do you regret them? And it just had become, I guess the best way to characterize it is 10 of the 11 Republicans on the committee turned in a letter saying they demanded to see confidential sealed pre-sentencing reports that are actually dangerous to release because they wanted to evaluate whether, in fact, she was soft on child predators. And so it had become not just mainstream. It became actually, I think, the focus of the ultimate attack.
Well, and I don't want to get too conspiratorial here, but Kim, this is a QAnon conspiracy about Democrats, you know, being soft on child pedophiles. There was the Pizzagate where this guy thought that there were Democrats and child pedophiles that were meeting there in a basement, went there with a gun. It was Judge Jackson who sentenced him to prison. And she talked about no matter how well-intentioned, people are not allowed to take matters into their own hands. Again, I don't want to connect dots where they're not there, but it's hard not to.
And I think this is a situation where it's both fair and necessary to connect those dots. And in large part, I think that's true because one of the lessons that we learned from Pizzagate is that when you promote these kinds of conspiracies, that some people will react with violence. And so the idea that we have these senators who are making it seem like Judge Jackson is, you know, a person who pals around with and in some way tries to protect people who are child sex predators literally puts her physically at risk. And the absolute irresponsibility of engaging in that behavior by sitting senators is really, I won't say it's quite shocking, because mm-hmm. that is unfortunately the world that we live in now, but it's certainly unacceptable.
And let me just play a clip, and this is Judge Jackson defending her sentencing records while we're talking about it.
What I say to him is, do you know that there is someone who has written to me and who has told me that she has developed agoraphobia? She cannot leave her house because she thinks that everyone she meets will have seen her, will have seen her pictures on the internet. They're out there forever. At the most vulnerable time of her life. And so she's paralyzed. I tell that story to every child porn defendant as a part of my sentencings so that they understand what they have done.
And that is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson speaking this week at her confirmation hearing before the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you want to join our conversation, and we certainly invite you to do so, there is a lot to talk about. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate, and Kimberly Mutcherson. She's co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. Let me read a couple of comments. Joseph said on our Facebook page, this is about Judge Jackson. I think she is a very patient person. A Facebook comment from Howard, who says, I find it interesting that they ask questions that are against the law to ask at any company, referring to the vetting process that they have been asking about her faith, etc. And I wonder if we could play a clip. And this is number six. And this is Senator Graham asking her about her personal faith. And then, Dahlia, I'll give you, and Kim, I'll give you a chance to respond to that.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful would you say you are in terms of religion? You know, I go to church probably 3 times a year, so that speaks poorly of me. Or do you attend church regularly?
Well, Senator, I am reluctant to talk about my faith in this way, just because I want to be mindful of the need for the public to have confidence in my ability to separate out my personal views.
Dahlia, is that a fair question to ask about someone's faith in that way?
I mean, it's not only unfair, obviously, it's also unconstitutional. It's not just that you can't ask it in a private employment setting. The Constitution prohibits religious tests for office. I think Senator Graham was trying to say this is reflective of the kinds of questioning that Amy Coney Barrett got when Judge Barrett was up before the Judiciary Committee, and there were questions about her faith. I guess I would say, to be fair, the difference was that Judge Barrett had signed letters as part of her church saying that Roe v. Wade was an atrocity. She had written law review articles explaining why her faith inflected on sentencing decisions. So in some sense, I think to compare them and to say, well, because Democrats roughed up Judge Barrett about faith, it's open season on Judge Jackson, I think slightly elides the problem, which was that in Judge Barrett's case, she had explicitly and overtly combined her faith and her judicial thinking for years before. Judge Jackson, as you heard in that clip, really, really struggles to keep them totally separate.
Let me ask you, Kim, about just this whole process. Justice Scalia got, I think, 90 plus votes to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg got almost the same, but well into the 90s. We're looking at an extremely divided Judiciary Committee and, of course, divided Senate. What has made this process so contentious and so partisan?
You know, I think in some ways it is simply a reflection of the politics that we are living with at this point. You know, even the fact that there are these sort of clear litmus tests for confirmations now, right? You have to get asked questions about Roe versus Wade. You have to get asked questions about stare decisis. You have to get asked questions about whether there's such a thing as a super precedent. And so, you know, as much as people and people in Congress themselves talk about the importance of the court being apolitical, it is very clear that the court is a political body, right? You know, one of the things that I thought was really powerful in the testimony on Tuesday was Senator Whitehouse talking about the Federalist Society and the role that they play in helping decide which judges are going to be appointed to the federal courts by Republicans. So this is, you know, these are not accidents that certain people get nominated for these roles. And that's sort of where we are now.
Here's a comment from Richard. It's unsurprising how fully the GOP has laminated the grab bag of white grievance complaints to itself. The race baiting, the gender baiting, the soft on crime. We're in it for white grievance demagogues like Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, or worse for a long time. Dolly, any comment to Richard's comment there?
Only just to amplify that Judge Jackson at some point was being asked about critical race theory books for toddlers that were taught at a school that she sits on the board of but has no connection to the curriculum. She was being asked about, you know, transgender athletes. She was literally being pinned down on issues that time and again she said, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, court expansion is not a thing I'm going to rule on. Like, I don't know what this is about. And it really did feel like it was kind of ticking the boxes of election clips that some of these senators want to run, where they say it is immaterial, that critical race theory is not an issue, that you don't judge based on it, that it's not coming before the court. I need to know how you feel about this children's book. And it very much felt as though it was building to this sort of midterm election commercial industry that had absolutely nothing to do with Judge Jackson or her thoughts on judging.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Can we say, Kim, that she was being used as a pawn for people who have ambitions for higher office?
I don't know necessarily that I would say that she was being used as a pawn, but I certainly think that the confirmation hearings are being used, you know, as Dahlia suggested, as a way to, you know, set folks up for their next election cycle, right? The midterms are coming up. There's certainly concern about what's going to happen in terms of Congress and who will be in the majority. And, you know, the sort of issues and the battle lines have been drawn, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, the idea that Senator Cruz would say, you know, what if I woke up tomorrow and decided that I was an Asian man? I mean, just things that are just a mockery of really serious issues, right, that people are trying to wrestle with in this country, and to treat those things so with such a lack of respect is unacceptable. I know I've said that a lot, but
No. I hear you. I hear you. Let me play, since we've been talking about this, let me play Senator Cruz trying to link Ketanji Brown Jackson with critical race theory in education, asking a number of questions about her speeches and about the curriculum of a private school upon whose board she sits.
Critical race theory frames all of society as a fundamental and intractable battle between the races. It views every conflict as a racial conflict. Do you think that's an accurate way of viewing society and the world we live in?
Senator, I don't think so, but I've never studied critical race theory and I've never used it. It doesn't come up in the work that I do as a judge.
Any thoughts on that, Kim?
Well, I mean, first of all, the idea that Senator Cruz had these, you know, huge poster boards with little clips from these books to try to, you know, throw these barbs at Judge Jackson was such a ridiculous bit of theater. But it is also the case, and this, you know, this is one of the things that I find so frustrating. these aren't stupid people. Senator Cruz is not a dumb person. Senator Hawley is not a dumb person. These are people who know exactly what they're doing. And these are people who know that the things that they are saying are inaccurate, right? Critical race theory, as described by Senator Cruz, is simply not what critical race theory is. Ibram X. Kendi is not a critical race theorist. So the idea that they are using this space where, as we said in the beginning, here's this historic nomination of somebody who has qualifications that are absolutely off the charts, and you are wasting time in confirmation hearings showing pictures from children's books and asking questions like, do you believe that babies are racist? I mean, it makes it hard to take the Senate seriously.
Well, and Dahlia, I mean, this always happens. People quote from Martin Luther King Jr. They talk about, you know, not being judged by the content of your skin, the color of your skin, but the content of your character. But they never talk about the rest of King's speech, where he talks about this promissory note of freedom and equality that is still yet to be delivered. We're almost up in a break here, but Dahlia, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was essentially the point that Cory Booker made in his closing, that here is Judge Jackson, whose parents went to segregated schools, who is finally about to ascend to the highest court of the land, and that promise is coming true. And I think that's the only rebuttal you can offer to people who are making cartoonish assertions about reverse racism and affirmative action and, you know, gamboling racist baby books for children.
Racist baby books for children. Yes, that's Dahlia Lithwick. And again, she writes for the courts and the law for Slate. She hosts the podcast called Amicus. Also with us, Kimberly Mutcherson. She's co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. And we are talking about what a lot of people are talking about today. And this was the confirmation hearing for the U.S. Supreme Court for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, play more clips, and hear more from our listeners. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about Judge Jackson's testimony earlier this week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She, of course, is President Biden's nominee to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. We've been talking about some of the questions and issues raised by the senators, a number of her responses, some of the underlying politics involved. And again, our guests are Kimberly Mutcherson, co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden, and Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate. I do want to play just about 50 seconds of Senator Cory Booker. This was last night. He got very emotional explaining about Jackson's nomination to the Supreme Court, what it means to him and to so many other people.
And I want to tell you, when I look at you, this is why I get emotional. I'm sorry, you're a person that is so much more than your race and gender. You're a Christian, you're a mom, you're an intellect, you love books, but for me, I'm sorry, it's hard for me not to look at you and not see my mom, not to see my cousins, one of them who had to come here and sit behind you. She had to have your back. I see my ancestors and yours. Nobody's gonna steal the joy of that woman in the street or the calls that I'm getting or the texts. Nobody's going to steal that joy. You have earned this spot. You are worthy. You are a great American.
To you, Dahlia, you mentioned in your article today that a lot of the Democrats really didn't come to Judge Jackson's defense, but obviously an exception is Cory Booker. He didn't really ask her any questions. He just said all those things for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think he just bore witness, and it was profound, and it was, I think, really, really necessary, because you know, with great, great credit to the Senate Democrats, who were really good at drilling down on questions about, you know, dark money, as Kim said, or questions about, you know, her approach to, you know, maritime law or whatever. What the moment really required was somebody saying what you heard there, which is, you know, these attacks are slanderous and you're extraordinary. And please, like, know that I see you. And I think I just also want to say, because I remember being in the chamber when Sonia Sotomayor went through her confirmation hearings, and she was also being derided at the time as not particularly smart and also as a bully, that I remember looking back behind me and seeing just lines of young Latina women who were standing there for hours so that they could watch history being made. And it's very, very powerful to remember. And we saw it outside the Supreme Court yesterday as young Black women also just stood up and said, suddenly my future is huge. I can see myself doing these things. I think that what Cory Booker was trying to say there is that to all those young women who, you know, feel the way Judge Jackson must feel, that maybe I don't belong in this place, you emphatically belong because this is what's best in America.
And Kim, you were there. I should say to our listeners, you were there on Tuesday.
Yeah, I was able to get tickets, and I was there for a couple of hours on Tuesday. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to say, and obviously I was there because I wanted to be a part of history, and there were a number of Black women law deans who I know have made the trek to D.C. in order to participate. But, you know, one of the things that I want to say about what Senator Booker did, well, two things that I want to say. One is he gave her time. Right. He didn't ask questions, and he made this like really beautiful speech. But it was also just an opportunity for her to just sit back for a few minutes, because she'd been there for hours and being assailed by people. But the second thing that I want to say, there's this really wonderful book of history. I was a history major in college called When and Where I Enter, which is a history of Black women in America. And part of what it is about is when you are a Black person, a Black woman in a space, that the whole race enters with you, right? That so many of us are standing on the shoulders of giants, and there are those of us who will stand on the shoulders of Judge Jackson. And it is so meaningful when you are, you know, a first, or you are one of very few in a room, to have somebody else have your back in that space. And that was so critical, both Senator Booker and Senator Padilla, who could talk from their own experiences and who could say, we see what's going on here, and we see you, and we know what you have done in order to get here, how exemplary you have had to be in order to get here, and we're not going to let you feel like you're alone in this space.
It's very powerful. Here's an email from Daryl. I was impressed with Judge Jackson and in favor of her nomination. If I were on the committee, I would vote for her twice. You're not allowed to do that, but I appreciate what you're saying there, Daryl. But she says, but when Senator Hawley asked her, do you ever regret giving him, this is the offender, only 3 months, why didn't she say, yes, I regret it, or explain why? She kept saying how terrible the crimes were, explain the process, and admit you made a mistake. Dolly, I'd just be curious about how you read that, how you see that.
I mean, I think in any other context, she might have been able to have that conversation. I think that it would have been just giving fuel to the fire to make a concession of that sort to Josh Hawley, who was using it to lash her to this idea that all of our children are unsafe. And I guess the other thing is she was making a larger point, which is when we do these sentences, even in these heinous cases, we can't know what's going to happen. We have to put a certain amount of trust into a system that seeks to, you know, both penalize them and rehabilitate them. And to suggest that she, you know, can go back with hindsight and know what was going to happen in a single case among hundreds, especially from, you know, Senator Hawley, who encouraged, you know, the nullification of the 2020 election. I just think none of us should have to stand up and say that I, with benefit of hindsight, I was wrong about something that is just a one instant in time, not reflective of her entire career.
I mean, I guess that would be the soundbite that would be, you know, heard around the world. Kim, she has worked as a defense attorney, and there were a number of questions coming from the Republicans, essentially questioning why someone is entitled to a defense attorney in this country. And I just want to, you know, you're the co-dean of the law school across the river there in Camden. Just about what our Constitution, what our judicial system says about the right to an attorney.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of stunning for people who are so often deeply focused on the text of the Constitution to decide that, you know, the right to remain silent and, you know, things that are articulated in the Constitution are not actually that important when you don't like the people who are the defendants. I've heard public defenders before, and I think this is so powerful, say, you know, I'm not representing people. I'm representing our Constitution, right? Our system doesn't work unless we have good lawyers on both sides. And that's what she was doing. She was making our system work, and we should be proud of that.
Let me play one more clip that we have, number 7. And this is, Judge Jackson being asked by Senator Marsha Blackburn to define the word woman. Let's give it a listen.
Can you provide a definition for the word woman?
Can I provide a definition?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah.
I can't.
You can't?
Not in this context.
So
I'm not a biologist.
The meaning of the word woman is so unclear and controversial that you can't give me a definition?
Senator, in my work as a judge, what I do is I address disputes. If there's a dispute about a definition, people make arguments, and I look at the law and I decide.
Well,
so I'm not.
The fact that you can't give me a straight answer about something as fundamental as what a woman is underscores the dangers of the kind of progressive education that we are hearing about.
Dahlia, you want to weigh in on that?
Just to say it's of a piece with questions about, you know, when life begins and whether a 20-week-old fetus can live outside the womb. I mean, these are all, again, just kind of the dartboard of things you would say if you were making a campaign commercial that have virtually nothing to do with the hearing in front of you.
And you're nodding your head rather vigorously, Kim.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I wonder, you know, what Senator Blackburn would say about people who are intersex. I wonder what Senator Blackburn would say about people who have an extra Y or an extra X chromosome, right? I mean, my guess is that she is neither a biologist or a geneticist. And so the idea that these are such easy categories, right? I mean, woman at one time meant you couldn't vote. Woman at one time meant you couldn't have a credit card in your own name. Woman at one time meant that you couldn't be a lawyer, right? So the idea that there are these sort of fixed categories and that if you're not on board with the fixed categories, that somehow you're part of the downfall of the country is just laughable.
And when Judge Jackson says, you know, if there's a dispute, you know, then I guess, do my homework and you know, sort of figure out what is the answer to this question.
That's exactly right. And it's sort of the same thing where, you know, Senator Cruz went through his what if I woke up and thought I were, you know, and decided I was an Asian man. If that was part of a controversy in an employment discrimination case, there would be arguments made on both sides about that. And a judge would make a decision. If you are a judge who is making decisions before you even see the papers, then you're not doing what you're supposed to do as a judge.
Dahlia, a couple of people agreeing with you. Richard says the Democrats were not forceful enough in responding to the bullying by the Republicans. Jane also says, though the Democrats did defend her, I agree with Dahlia Lithwick that their defense should have been much louder and angrier to match the horrible implications of Holly Cotton et al. Trying to figure out how to frame my question here. I mean, do you think it's sort of more in the Democrats' personality to sort of hold their fire, whereas it seems Republicans are not shy about that? Or what, you know, do you have a sense of what was going on, maybe more sociologically or psychologically or even politically?
I mean, you know, I'm not a sociologist, and I wouldn't purport to make sweeping claims, but I do think that, you know, anger has been a big motivator on the political right for decades now. You can think about, you know, Alex Jones shrieking into the microphone for InfoWars or Rush Limbaugh. And I think what we saw from Senator Graham, Senator Hawley, Senator Cruz was just kind of another iteration of this. I think Kim talked about this, you know, white male prerogative to shout and scream with impunity, whereas the black woman in front of you has to just keep her face utterly still and absorb it. So I think part of what I think we see from Democrats is that the response to that is this very careful, lawyerly, hyper-intellectual, in response. And also, I think, a tendency to say, they're there, you're very brave, you're very brave, you're so brave. But of course, in that moment, and I'm thinking now of Christine Blasey Ford, who similarly was told over and over again how brave she was for absorbing body blows. I just don't think, and I'm, by the way, not making an argument for Democrats screaming in rage, you know, louder, but I think that there needs to be a response that is commensurate with the attack. And it just seemed to me as though saying, you know, but enough about all these screaming Republicans, you know, let's talk about your family, is just not adequate to the moment.
And that's Dahlia Lithwick, who joins us along with Kim Murchison. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I know you want to add to that, Kim.
No, you know, I was just sort of thinking that the other piece of that puzzle is, you know, as Dahlia said, do we want a Senate where people are just screaming at each other constantly? I don't think that that's the goal. And so part of it may also be, you know, the Democrats saying, we want you to see the contrast between who we are, how we carry ourselves, what our expectations are of what it means to sit in this chamber, you know, versus people who are treating it like a cage match.
What would you have asked her, Kim?
I would have asked her about things that have to do with being a judge, right? I would have asked her about, you know, how she thinks about, you know, when litigants are before her and how she thinks about, you know, interpreting the Constitution and is it a living document? And I mean, those are the kinds of things that actually have relevance to what it means to be a Supreme Court justice. And obviously, as they well know, she cannot opine on issues that are going to end up before the court, right? Issues about trans folks will end up before the court. Issues about gender will end up before the court. Issues about race will end up before the court. She can't talk about those things. So it really is just a, you know, this is an opportunity to get a sense of who a person is in their professional role. And this process has not been about that.
Well, indeed. And Dahlia, what we have about a minute before we have to end our conversation. What would you have asked her?
One of the things I really was struck by in Judge Jackson's biography is the extent to which she is not a political animal. Unlike a lot of folks on the court, she's written briefs for, you know, right-wing groups and left-wing groups. She's, you know, beloved by the police and also by victims' rights. And I think that that's such a unique and singular experience and really lacking at the court. And so I would have really loved to hear about the ways in which she has, in ways that are really remarkable, worked across the aisle throughout her career and how modeling that at the court could change things.
Well, it will be interesting to see how that works out. My thanks to both of you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Dahlia Lithwick, as I said, it's been a little while. Thanks for coming back on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate, and she hosts the podcast called Amicus. Kimberly Murchison, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as
Absolutely
well.
Absolutely a pleasure.
And she is co-dean and professor of law at Rutgers Law School in Camden. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.